who shared the Mediterranean with the Phoenicians. And these Celts and the house of Qumri pushed across the nations to end up in these islands were the lost tribes. What if that was Jeremiah who landed in 585 B.C.? Now we understand Isaiah who shouted to the islands, "Keep thou silent, O isles of the sea, and let the people renew their strength." What if Leviticus 26 were the promises, punishment seven times? And what if that seven times can be calculated in history to the moment when God begins to lift the veil and the lost is found? What if what Jeremiah said is true in the proper translation? The house of Judah will walk not with, but to the house of Israel restored. Don't tell me that they're lost. Hosea says, after they become not my people and not having obtained mercy, yet they shall increase as the sand of the sea into a multitude of nations. What if it is true that the house of Judah will walk to the house of Israel, and it will be the house of Israel restored that makes it possible for Judah to return to the homeland? They don't know who they are. The reason the Jews have never found the 10 lost tribes, they've been looking for people with Jewish traits. They're not Jews. They're Gentiles. Jesus knew about them. He knew about the lost sheep of Israel. James wrote a letter to the 12 tribes. He wasn't speaking spiritually. He knew exactly what he was doing. If he's speaking spiritually, then the Jews are totally left out of God's blessing in any respect. He knew all 12 tribes existed, as John does when he writes, and God in inspiration says that 144,000 from all the tribes will be sealed. You say, "Do you know the answer?" I sure do. But I ain't ready to tell you yet. I want you to come to your own conclusion. No, I'm not a British Israelite, but I'm telling you, God hasn't lost those tribes, never have been lost. He knows where they are. And I'm returning tomorrow night to the research that will prove God never forgets one jot or tittle, and exactly what Jesus said is true. Not a jot or tittle will pass away until all be fulfilled. God knows where those dry bones are. He knows when to resurrect them. And Hosea made it clear, in the place that you were known as not my people, in the place that you were known as not having obtained mercy, in the place that you were Jezreel scattered, then you will know, and it shall be told you, ye are the sons of the living God. And realization that God has never forgotten them will return to them. Don't talk to me about genealogical perfection. God not only had to find a people, he had to protect the throne. And he had to keep every jot and tittle of his word to David. The kingdom of the Khazars for 4 centuries, sons of Japheth, as a nation, converted to Judaism and stood between the tug of war of the Byzantium kingdom and the Muslim kingdoms, and became the place for outcast Jewry for 4 centuries in the Middle Ages. Sons of Japheth, welcome to returned Israel today, treated as Exodus says, by one law as the strangers are to be treated. Why didn't you call the sons of Joseph Egyptians instead of Israelites? They were half Egyptian. God can trace the lineage through the smallest drop. if necessary, to prove his faithfulness. God hasn't forgotten these people. And I'm having fun with our little detective game, but I'm telling you, if you'll be watching, as I told you tonight, quickly, who the Drews were, I'll answer the questions. Who's responsible for Russia? And whence comes the name Rus? Was it a Viking settlement? Or were the Slavs the foundation of that nation? And the Vikings the intruders? And where'd they come from? Who are the Franks, the Goths, the Celts, the Ostrogoths? Who are these people that ironically took their vengeance on both the Assyrians, the Muslims, and the Romans? Why does every record uncovered point to that strange appearing out of nowhere? And they aren't Slavs. They were followed by the Huns. Why they all appear at exactly that point in time when Esdras says, in a year and a half, they broke through the gate through the Caucasus Mountains. The evidence is overwhelming, and I don't intend to let up on it until we figure out who this Olam Paula was. And what about this strange document here? The Book of Tephi. Tephi, born in the house of the High Ones, princes of Zion, home of the house of God, daughter of David, shepherd of Judah, tribe of the Lion, queen over Bethel and Dan, where they be scattered abroad. Who is this person out of the bards of Ireland on a moonless night and a cloudy? We shipped and we passed away in the vales of the Lord from Egypt. The breath of his mouth was our stay. 3 weeks in our sails to westward, thus favor was in the eyes of the men of the ship upon us, and I talked with our pilot wise. Bucai, the son of Helak, whose marvelous words were true, he had gathered in many waters, an old man now from his youth, who in barks of Dan and Javan had raised up sails as a boy for the sons of some that Ulick, son of Lear, brought back from Troy. I heard of the painted talking birds in gardens with the fruits of gold, and fish islands spouting fountains, and one terrible tale he told. What about the men consulted together and marveled upon that spot? And Boedon, the son of Bucai, was chosen of them by lot to lead our skiff to the shore and find of the folk thereby what hap had fallen upon us and whether our course should lie. What about the references? In a short space we draw unto Eber, a land of mountain and vale, purple and gold were its hills, and the prophet took up his tale. Thou art servant to Baal, O Heber, a servant of him that shall slay the leopard of Baal and his bull. The strength is taken away before the winds of the north, before the wind of the south, till Gad and Tarshish arise to rend the bits from their mouth. Swift upon wheels they roam, yea, wheeling follow the course of the sun in his fields afar. They're each as swift as red horse. Who is this Olam Paula? 2 months we took much counsel to find us a further aid for our journey beyond the sea porch, but at last a pact was made with a Racklin who came out of Lud, but in Canaan Dor was his birth, and he traded in many waters to all the ends of the earth. And a daughter of Dan was the mother of Necbo. She knew where Dan lay coiled as a serpent, watching all the birds as they flew. Who is this Tiatephi? 5 weeks we abode at Pensawel, till the men of the land returned with tidings whereat the prophet rejoiced, and my spirit burned. At Penadair they heard of peace, how Eriu yearned for the choice of a guard against evil rulers, and the air cried with one voice upon Jochad, the son of Duach, a prince of the tribe of Dan, a champion wise and mighty and sprung of that chosen clan. What is it? You want to hear the rest of this? Huh? Thank you.
1-800-338-3030 is the phone number to use if you live in the United States. That's 1-800-338-3030. If you are calling from South America, the Caribbean, Europe, Mexico, Africa, Canada, or anywhere else in the world, call Colette to area code 818-240-8151. That's 818-240-8151.
I picked up as I've been moving back toward Ireland, because I really want to bring us by St. Patrick's Day to an understanding of that. And when we get close to Easter, I'm going to have to concentrate on Easter the way I did on Christmas. And if you think I blew some traditions at Christmas, well, Easter rolls around. Where do you think we get the name Easter? Just a transliteration of Ishtar, the Phoenician equivalent of Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod. Or you think the Easter egg got in on the act? It's that Saturn sign, the yolk surrounded by the white and the shell of the egg. We think rabbits came in. It's a fertility celebration in ancient Babylon and ancient Phoenicia. Need I say any more about rabbits? So I got to get some things done, but I ain't promising the pyramid before Easter. But as I teed off a little when I came in here on those that would maybe put me in the British Israelite camp, and I am not, I am laying down the weight of evidence, all of which creates a foci that must be explained. What happened in the area just south of the Caucasus Mountains between the Tigris River and the Caspian Sea in the 7th century, or rather 8th century, toward the close of it, B.C.? What happened just north of the Caucasus Mountains and north and around the Black Sea in the 7th century B.C. And what happened between the 7th and the 6th century B.C. in that same area and in the areas to the north and west of it? That until the archaeological finds and the studies in philology and the breakdown of the false premise of the Greco-Roman, Greek and Roman domination of the world and all culture radiating from that, in the 18th century that has opened up these territories. Now, where did the ancient Celts, the remnants of which can be found in their purest form in Ireland and Scotland, sections of England, come from? Don't tell me I'm basing anything on some tenuous verse in Leviticus. No prophecy of Scripture is of private interpretation to me. I like to bait you. Where did Jeremiah die? And where did he plant and build the kingdoms that God assigned him as trustee over? And what is the explanation of Ezekiel 23 and Ezekiel 17 and Ezekiel 37 and Hosea and Romans 9? I have read from so many books, most of you can't even remember them. The names, much less what's in them. Ireland, an illustrated history. Exactly when the Celts started coming to Ireland and whether they came in peace or as conquerors is not clear. How many times have you heard that? Two groups of Celts populated the British Isles, the Gaels and the Brythoni. In some cases, translated Brittoni. What is Brit? Covenant. Why do these Celts or Celts, when they finally get a written language, why do they write Greek backwards, as we would see it, from right to left? Which is the Hebrew way. I take the same letters and write them backwards. Do I think, you might ask, that the Celts were the only nomads? My lands, no. They were settled in the midst of nomads who became a nation spawning the longest monarchy the world has probably seen. With the fall of the peacock throne in Ireland, or rather in Iran, that dated itself back to Cyrus and beyond. We have a people that started out as nomads and settled down, the Medes and the Persians, the Indo-Aryans. Aryan simply means noble, if you don't know that. The nobles, nobody knows from whence they came. They descend on the plateaus. The roots of their language found in the Indus Valley of India. The Indo-Aryans were not a racial group. They were a language similarity group. Both the Medes and the Persians were part of that nomadic wave that swept down off of the plateaus and settled in that area. The Assyrians, when they conquered the 10 tribes to the north in 722 BC, carrying the capital city Samaria east of the Tigris, settling the people among the Medes, it only took 60 years before the Medes, cooperating with the Babylonians, annihilated Nineveh. And while they were settling down, later to be dominated by the other branch of the Indo-Aryans that came in there, the Persians, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom took shape. Cyrus unites the Medes and the Persians and conquers Babylon. But the Medes were nomadic. And the 10 tribes learned from them. The Medes were master horsemen. And though Solomon kept stables of tens of thousands, as chariot men they were known, and the Syrians were known as charioteers. The Medes were horsemen. And those 10 tribes settled there, expanded their horsemanship. And when they settled north of the Caucasus Mountains, assuming they went through it, as Ezra says, we know they encountered people, predecessors of themselves, sparsely settled in the areas they were in, and we know that pressing in from all sides were the Slavic nomads moving in later to become known to everyone under such names as Attila the Hun. But there's still a mystery of history. The Celts appear full-orbed in the 7th century. Exactly when they started coming to Ireland, and whether they came in peace or as conquerors is not clear. The Brittoni or Brithoni settled in Britain, and the Gaels occupied Ireland and some of Scotland. They brought with them the Iron Age, which had begun some 300 years earlier in Central and Eastern Europe. Iron swords were stronger than bronze, and iron plows dug deep and were long-lasting. The Bronze Age settlers had never been slow to adopt new metallurgical discoveries, so it is difficult to be certain at which point they were superseded by the Celts' iron culture, but by 500 B.C., Ireland was probably a completely Celtic country, enjoying the widespread use of iron implements. Give them 100 years to migrate. We're out of the 6th century now. We're out of the 7th century into the 6th. And by the end of the 6th century B.C., totally settled in Ireland. The Celts themselves seem to have originally come from the lands around the Caspian Sea, migrating from there in stages in all directions. The first mention of the Celts dates from the 6th century B.C., carried into bondage as the houses of Israel in 722, 50 to 55 years later, rebelling by the words of Darius, moving through the Caucasus Mountains according to Esdras, were in about 670, 660 B.C. First historical mention, 6th century. The Gaelic Celts, in fact, possessed a highly sophisticated society. They rapidly made their mark on Ireland. Gaelic society was tribal in organization. The Gaels differed from other Celtic tribes in maintaining the system of kingship for so long. These, then, were the Celts or Celts, tribes of which were to dominate Ireland for over 1,300 years until Viking incursions challenged their supremacy. All the records we have come out of Christian Europe. Written records, probably by monks who transcribed the lays and the legends that were word of mouth. Observations of them are from heathen historians, Herodotus, Tacitus, and Julius Caesar, describing his wars. It is a fact to pick just one I strained our minds with the other night. The trait of the Tuatha De Danann that their kings did not just rule by power alone. It was required of them that they be kingly. An ideal for kingship. Ruidims. Breens. Hospitality houses. All over Ireland. Before anybody got there with a Bible out of the medieval church or a monk to teach him Old or New Testament. A breen was always set at the junction of several roads, frequently the junction of six. It had open doors facing every road and a man stationed on each road to make sure that no one passed unentertained. It had a light burning on the lawn at night, a full cauldron always boiling on the fire, stocked with provisions of all kinds in plenty. The six chief breens of Ireland were asylums of refuge for homicides, like the six Jewish cities of refuge. Where in the world could that idea have come from? You don't have to be a British Israelite to ask, where did that come from? And I've laid it down night after night by the hundreds. Why is the Irish word for judge done? The equivalent of Dan, Din, Dan, or Dun, or Don, since there is no vowel in the Hebrew. Dan shall judge. Why is it the poetic prophet and seer occupies a place equal with kings? Who was this strange man, Olamfala, with a daughter of a king marrying King Eramon, 585 B.C.? Strange date again. Setting up Murallam, the school of the prophets. These are questions that deserve an answer. I still want to know, was that pyramid a time capsule laid down by Enoch, or was Ham trying to impress his father? Did somebody in touch with God build it? Or they get demon help. Don't worry, I'm getting back to the pyramid. Why'd they build that king's chamber that no king was buried in? With the exact measurements of what? The ark. Yeah, I want to get back to teaching. I want you to get your faith muscles in shape. I want you in the King's House Sunday. I'm going to tell you. You all can find your place. I'm going to tell you what I don't know. Anywhere, anytime, that any theologians ever addressed. In the book of Genesis, chapter 49, Jacob is blessing his sons. Verse 8, you all know this promise. Judah, he says, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down. He couched as a lion, as an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Now, theological controversy has swirled around that 10th verse for centuries. Those who believe the lost tribes disappeared and have to deal with the fact that some can say, where has Judah fulfilled that promise? Scepter not depart, lawgiver not depart until Shiloh come, and they say Shiloh, those that know that Judah, Jews, lost the scepter when Christ came, either argue for a spiritual kingdom over the Christians and the hearts and lives through Christ. That's it. They argue that. They say Shiloh was his first coming. But the problem with that is the scepter wouldn't depart until two things happened. Shiloh come and the gathering of the people be. The first coming of Christ was not Shiloh coming. And I've said several times, I'll come to that. So the debate is concentrated on where did a seed of Judah have a throne once Judah's throne was cut off, the kingdom of Judah. You understand that? Nobody's asked the question, when did Jacob say this to Judah? Verse 27, 47th chapter of Genesis. Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. That's not very far into it, is it? And when did they go down into Egypt? About 1843 B.C., some people say, is when he entered Egypt. So just round it off 1800, because dates are that far. 1800 B.C. Jacob went down into Egypt. Chronological Bible dates his death at 1826 B.C., so, you know, we're playing with 20 years. 20 to 40 years. Anybody that thinks they can date it closer than that, when we're 2,000 years B.C., 50 years differential doesn't mean much. So let's make it easy to remember. You know, you can just remember the dates rather easily. You'll be about 40 to 50 years off. Abram, start dating him about 2,000 B.C., and have Jacob going into Egypt about 1800 B.C., and you'll be within 50 years, if you want to round figure it. After he got into Egypt, he dwelt there 17 years, right? Now, his descendants are going to stay there 400 years. Right? Twenty-seven years into 400 is a small little bite, isn't it? So that means when he says Judah, the scepter will not depart from Judah, there's 375 years left in Egypt. Right? Where did Judah have a scepter for 375 years? I mean, was this a promise that wasn't to take effect until 375 years later? If there can be a 375-year gap just fudged away, then who gives a hoot about the rest of the gaps? But the promise is, thing. At that moment, a promise is given to this lion's whelp. Scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. How come nobody has asked the question, where was Judah's descendants holding a scepter from about 1780 B.C.? If you take 1800 B.C. is when Jacob went down to Egypt with his family, and he lived there 17 years, you got the prophecy somewhere around 1780, 1783 B.C., right or wrong? Now, where was a descendant of Judah ruling from 1780 B.C. to 1500 B.C., or to 1400 B.C.? That 370 years while they were in bondage. Now, that's the cliche statement. They weren't in bondage. They didn't get into bondage until a long, long time. Right? Let's just read about this. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die, and he called his son Joseph and said unto him, if now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. Now, wait a minute. If they were just a bunch of shepherds, 70 of them, with about 15 tents, wandering around in Palestine, who went down to Egypt because Joseph had come to power there, they sure left a vacuum up in Palestine. What in the world does Joseph want to be buried there for? Or rather, Jacob. But he has a very clear-cut idea. He wants to be buried in their burying place. Wonder who's been tending their grave. I mean, if they were a despicable people, there wouldn't be any burial place to go to. Now, let's take a look at Joseph. Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, chapter 47, my father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they're in the land of Goshen. He took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? They said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. Now, you've got to understand, most historians and archaeologists don't believe the Bible. They're as bad as the people were toward Homer. Takes a hard head like Schliemann to say, I start with Homer. Well, old Scott starts with the Bible. That's what this teaching's all about. Thy servants are shepherds. Isn't that interesting? It freezes me to death, Peter. Go turn some heat on in here. They said, moreover, unto Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land that we come, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. Now, I'm sure you've read this hundreds of times. I'm only trying to enrich God's word by showing you what happens when you see the other side of the fence, archaeology and history. The land of Egypt is before thee. In the best of the land, underline these words, in the best of the land, make thy father and brethren to dwell. That's not treatment you give slaves, is it? In the land of Goshen, let them dwell. And if thou knowest any men of activity, if you look in the margin, it's ability or integrity. Men of ability among them, make them rulers over my cattle. Now, not only is Joseph made a ruler, the king of Egypt wants these shepherds to rule over his cattle. Got it? Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Now, anybody knows that in Old Testament, this is where the controversy around Melchizedek has come. And this is the total argument that Paul uses in the New Testament for the superiority of the priestly line of Melchizedek over Aaron. Because he says Aaron was in Abram's loins. Not born yet. When Abram was blessing Melchizedek, therefore Aaron, or rather, not blessing, paying tithe to Melchizedek and getting blessing from Melchizedek. Therefore, Melchizedek was superior. You only bless if you are over. Here's Jacob blessing Pharaoh. Jacob may have lived in a land beset by famine, but Jacob wasn't no second-rate sheep herder. Got that? Now, let's assume their relatives, just assume, what if their relatives over Padan Aram, Haran, what if their relatives were the Hittites or the rulers over the Hittites? The Proto-Haitians were the aborigines ruled over by somebody that came out of, they used to think, Indo-European north of the Black Sea, but no more. They came from out of a knowledge of the Akkadian, the old Babylonian Ur of the Chaldees kingdom. Now, what if the brothers and relatives of Abram ruled over the Hittites? And when Abram moved into Canaan, he wasn't no little piker. His fight against the kings in Damascus tell you that. Now, do you know anything about Bible geography? Do you have any idea where Jacob was when he sent Joseph to find his brethren, and they weren't there? And when he discovered where they were, he went to find them way north. I mean, it's as though we've got the King Ranch in Texas. I mean, they didn't have to wonder where to water or graze their flocks. The whole land of Canaan seemed to be open to them. Now, relatives of the strongest empire to the north, if their relatives ruled it, are stricken by famine in the sovereignty of God because Abram asked God to prove that all the land would be his. Okay? They'll go to a strange land. They'll end up slaves there, but not when they start. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said unto Jacob, he didn't take offense at it. Here's the most powerful leader, it used to be thought in the world, but now we know, since they dug up the Hittite kingdom, they weren't. The Hittites were stronger. So the most powerful kingdom in the world known for many years, and successor of the pharaohs of Egypt, but no longer as powerful, was not resentful of this shepherd tribal chieftain saying unto him, blessing him. Pharaoh said, hold, are you? Jacob said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil of the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage. Isn't that strange? He belittles himself alongside his father. That means Isaac must have been pretty powerful too. Then he blessed Pharaoh again. I mean, we live in the days when to go in the presence of a king without his approval would bring death. I mean, by analogy, I can only think of Oral Roberts marching into Queen Elizabeth's throne room, laying hands on her and saying, I bless you. Even Oral couldn't get away with it. And that's a modern kingdom. Here's this old shepherd. Knowing the way the Egyptians bathed and perfumed, he obviously didn't smell like some shepherds I know. I remember what my dad did to me when I decided to be a sheep herder. He blessed him again. Now listen to this. Joseph placed his father and his brethren. Hey, we're supposed to be teaching on Genesis, so I can go back to it once in a while, can I? Joseph placed his father and his brethren and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. He nourished his family. 13th verse describes the famine, so that all the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up how much of the money in Egypt? All the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan. Sunday school lessons have suggested that what we have happening when Jacob comes down out of Canaan is some old shepherd with a few stragglers begging their way in. We got the most powerful man in Canaan coming to Egypt. You understand that? We got the tribal chieftain of Canaan coming to Egypt. We got a meeting between rulers. Jacob was as much a ruler in Canaan as Pharaoh was in Egypt. There ain't nobody going to find anything to contradict that. It only makes sense of what happens. How many despotic kings of the world, even if their son's sitting on a throne? Look how difficult it was for Esther, the wife of the queen. I meant the wife of the queen. The wife of the king. Well, you know, there's some strange things in history, but that's too strange. The wife of the king. She sure couldn't bring Mordecai into the presence of the king loosely. Even she feared to go in the king's presence. We got a ruler coming with a son who married. Whom did he marry? Go back and look. When Joseph interpreted the dream of Pharaoh, whom did he marry? Come on. Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I'm Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. How's that for power? Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. Today I've set thee over all the land of Egypt. Who does that tell you is ruling in Egypt? I'm in 42nd chapter, 41st verse. Who's ruling Egypt? Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I've set thee over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand, put it upon Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck. Made him to ride in the second chariot which he had. That's like if President Reagan has two limos, Joseph rides in the other one. He made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, bow the knee. And he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. Right or wrong? Is that what it says? Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. How's that for power? And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, man of food during famine, it means, and gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, Heliopolis, that is. And Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Okay, who's the boss? All right, let's watch him boss. 14th verse of Genesis 47. Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan. Now, what authority did Joseph have over Canaan? The boss of Canaan had moved down there, too. By what authority is he getting all the money in Canaan? He gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which was bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house, literally treasury. And when money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, where did it fail? Both places. All the Egyptians came into Joseph and said, give us bread. For why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth or is consumed. Now watch the boss. Joseph said, give your cattle and I'll give you for your cattle if money fail. They brought their cattle into Joseph. Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for the flocks and for the cattle of the herds and for the asses, and he fed them with bread for all their cattle that year. When that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him, we'll not hide it from my lord how that our money is spent. My lord now has our herds of cattle. There's not aught left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Who's the boss? Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread. We and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. Bought the whole land. Boy, talk about the Zinzendorf of Egypt. I mean, here's the champion real estate trader of the world. He gets all the money, gets all the stock. I mean, the Hunt brothers tried to corner silver. When have they got their idea from Joseph? He bought how much of the land? All. How many of you have been taught this all your life, never paying attention to what you're reading? Huh? Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold every man his field. because the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. Play that song again.